Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and theologian in residence of Canvas Community in Little Rock, Arkansas.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning and Music at Congregation Or Chadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish, one Christian.
This week, we're reading the story of the first Easter as told in Mark 16, 1-8. In this most challenging version of the Easter story, we never encounter the resurrected Jesus. Rather, a young man in white tells the women to go to Galilee where Jesus will meet them. It's strange not to see Jesus on Easter, but isn't this the way we mostly live our lives? We live the life of faith, based on the testimony of others, and mostly without tangible evidence, trusting that Jesus really is resurrected, just as the young man said. But Mark tells us that the women, startled and overwhelmed, left the tomb in silence, saying nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So it falls to us, as the readers, to make a choice. Will we go to meet Jesus as the young man instructed? Do we have enough faith to meet Jesus in Galilee? Thanks for joining us. Amy, it's the Bible Worm Easter Sunday episode.
Happy Easter Sunday episode, Bobby.
Thanks to all who celebrate. It is so funny, like, doing Bible Worm because, you know, we record several weeks ahead. And so I'm, like, liturgically, I'm always off kilter. And I think, you know, like, it's Easter, but really,
it's not Easter.
Right. Yeah, it confuses me, but.
Yeah. Do you have any, like, process for trying to get your, for lack of a better word, like, spirit into this season of the, like, for a week like today, not, right, you know, for like some random week, but like, I imagine whatever period we're actually in now on the Christian calendar is, like, feels pretty different than Easter Sunday.
Yes, we're dead in the middle of Lent right now as we record. Yes.
Do you want to do some kind of, like, meditative practice? We can just pause the podcast.
Pause the podcast and be
get
silent
into
for
your,
a while.
Into the zone.
Yes. Yeah. What's going on with you, Amy? It's not Easter in your world, in many senses.
No, it's not Easter in my world. Let's see. I have actually declared the month ahead for me personally to be the month of no, during which I will say no to every possible thing I can say no to. Of course, there are things you cannot say no to.
Right.
Fine. But I have filled my days with so many wonderful and fantastic activities that truly are each on their own wonderful and fantastic.
Yes.
But heaped up in a big pile, they become a checklist of things that I have to accomplish.
Yes.
And that brings honor to nobody.
The month of no. I like it.
The month of no. My name is no. My number is no. You need to let it go. You don't know that song?
I don't.
Oh, no, it's I didn't just make it.
I was really impressed with you. I was like, man, you should have had a totally different career.
Yeah, I know. I didn't make up that song.
You know, most of my music these days is things like the Bluey Dance Mode soundtrack and the Lion Guard soundtrack and a fair amount of Taylor Swift. I have the musical stylings of a six-year-old girl.
I was going to say the target audience for the first couple that you mentioned does not need help saying no.
They do not.
They are very well.
No is the best word. Yes.
In the no.
It is true. It is true. I don't know how to get from there to Easter, Amy. Do you?
Negative. No, I don't. My name is no. I don't know. I don't know.
This is
going to
totally change the podcast if you just say no to things you don't want to talk about. No.
Nope.
Well, Amy, the last time that you and I were together on the podcast, we did a special episode on the Maundy Thursday, Jesus's Last Supper with his disciples. We have also released an old episode of the story of the crucifixion. So as we get our heads ready for this Mark 16 resurrection text, given those two episodes that we've done recently, is there anything that we need to think about, have in our minds?
I mean, you know, I tried to read the intermediate text in preparation for this episode, and it just was so painful mm-hmm. for me that after a certain point, I was like, you know, we're not actually discussing this.
Right.
I know what happens.
Right.
And so I decided not to take on the enormity of the weight of the chapter in between, but it is enormous.
Yes.
All of the foreboding and anxiety that has been building up comes to the biggest the biggest fruition, and it is excruciating, and Jesus is crucified. I think that what we need most immediately to know as we head into chapter 16 is that it's on a Friday, there is someone named Joseph who requests permission to take his body down from the cross.
Yes.
And so they check to make sure that he has actually died, and he has indeed actually died. The request to take him down on that particular day is because it's about to be the Sabbath, and it would be really not a great thing to have a body just up on a crucifix for the entirety of the Sabbath.
Yes.
So they take the body down and wrap the body in a linen cloth and put it in a tomb that was hewn out of rock and roll the stone in front of the tomb. And it tells us that Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, I don't know who that is, saw where the body was laid.
Yes.
And then that's it. Then it's Shabbat. Between chapter 15 and the beginning of chapter 16 is just like this cosmic pause. It's Shabbat.
Cosmic pause. I like that way of saying that. You get the sense that in which the burial of Jesus happens really quickly, like they're sort of rushing to get it all done.
They're just trying to get him down
before the Sabbath begins.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Into a more dignified place for his body before the Sabbath.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The only other thing that I would remind us about is that in the previous two texts, in the one we did for Maundy Thursday, that's the one in which Judas betrays Jesus. And then in the Good Friday text, which you've talked about, that is when Peter denies Jesus and all the disciples run away. And that one dude runs away naked because he's in such a hurry that he loses his clothes. And Jesus, when he dies, says, my God, why have you forsaken me? So there's been this sort of sense in which Jesus has been completely abandoned. Mm-hmm. We did get a little notice at the end of the crucifixion story in verse 15:40, that some of the women who had been following Jesus were still, they were a ways away from him, but they were still watching, and they were present as close as they could be, which is an interesting dynamic. But just that sense in which Jesus really has, in Mark's gospel, more starkly than in some of the other tellings, he's completely alone.
Yeah.
When he dies. And that I think that's going to become important in this text. Mm. All right, Amy. So this Easter text is a short one in 16:1-8. I suppose the other thing that we might say is that the gospel of Mark, as it is in most Bibles, continues on beyond verse 8.
Mm.
But the understanding of scholars based on manuscript evidence and also the way early church fathers talked about the Gospel of Mark, like Eusebius and others, is that in fact Mark ended originally at verse 8, and the things we get from verse 9 through the end in verse 20 are later additions by presumably early Christian writers or copyists mm-hmm. who were really troubled by the ending of Mark 16:8. As we'll see. And so they're like, we just can't let that be the end of this. So they added some things.
Yeah.
So what we'll do, and what the narrative lectionary does, and what most sort of historically interested readers of the Bible do, is to say Mark actually ends at 16:8, and this is the whole story. And so that's the way we're going to approach it.
Mm.
So I'm beginning in Mark 16:1, and I'm reading in the Common English Bible. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they could go and anoint Jesus' dead body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they came to the tomb. They were saying to each other, "Who's going to roll the stone away from the entrance for us?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, and it was a very large stone. I said that funny, but that's like a little parenthesis in the Common English Bible.
I mean,
just so you know, it was a very large stone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, Amy. So we start out with the notice that the Sabbath was over. Can you just talk about, like, you were talking about the great pause or something like that. Can you just talk about the significance of waiting until the Sabbath is over and where we are in the timeline, do you think?
Yeah, I felt particularly moved this year by the timing of this, sort of that the crucifixion and then the Sabbath in between, when just nothing, there's nothing reported. You know, it is the day of rest and people rested.
Yeah.
So what came to my mind as I was preparing to talk to you today is there's a midrash, a rabbinic sort of story based on the biblical text, where the rabbis are asking why humans were only created on the sixth day towards the end of creation. And they give a lot of reasons and, you know, argue about them. But the one that is sort of sticking in my mind right now is that this serves as a reminder that God's purpose for humans is not primarily that we keep busy and work. That, like, we do have to work, but in the creation story, the very first thing a human has to do is rest. Like, you're created and then you rest. And during that time, you sort of appreciate the enormity of creation and, you know, find yourself in this new space so that you can begin again on Sunday. So as I was reading it this week, it made me think about creation is what it made me think. It made me think about, like, the Christian sense that something has fundamentally changed. And it started to change before Shabbat, but then the first thing you do is nothing. That's the first thing you do.
Yes.
And then they rise early in the morning on the first day of the week into a totally new world that in ways that they don't even know yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The timing of it feels like creation to me.
I really love that, Amy. And, you know, we have said on the podcast before about Sabbath and the insistence that you don't have to work all the time and that kind of observance of Sabbath. But the way you're saying that really puts a different kind of lens on it for me, that even when the world has seemed to come undone for you on Friday late afternoon, or there is some sort of experience that you don't know how to make sense of, yet still there is Sabbath. I don't quite know, because when something like this would happen to me, I want to stay busy, right? I want to not think about it. And so I often just think about those poor disciples on that whole long Saturday, Sabbath day, where they can't do anything, but the world just takes a breath.
The way that you said that, Bobby, made me think too, I think this is a poem, maybe by someone who sort of works in the world of, you know what a death doula is?
I don't know that term, but I mean, I can get there.
You can imagine what it is. Yeah, a doula is someone who sort of helps you through the process of birth, and a death doula is someone who helps you through the process of death. And what I remember is the line, "When someone dies, the first thing you should do is nothing." Like, everything in you is going to say, do something. You have to do something. There's something you can do about this. You need to keep busy, as you're saying. Like, that is the human response, I think. But this placement before, right, going into Shabbat, like, really insists, like, no, the first thing you're going to do is nothing.
Yes. That's so powerful.
And just let it be.
So these women seem to have done that. And now we are on early on the morning of the first day of the week, which is a Sunday. The framing of that as the first day of the week may reflect a Christian understanding from later than the time of Jesus that shifts the Sabbath day in Christian thinking from Saturday to Sunday. It may just be saying the first day of the week comes after the last day of the week, which is also true. It's maybe less theologically profound.
I mean, that's how you'd say it in Hebrew too. Yom Rishon is Sunday, like the first day
of the week.
The first day is Sunday, but it may also reflect that Christian understanding. I don't know.
Christians, it's shift the Sabbath, of course.
Yes,
because of this, it's the resurrection day. But I don't know if Mark is doing that right here. I think that's a fair question. These three women who are mentioned here, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, are the same women who are named in that chapter 15 that we were talking about a minute ago, who were still close enough to the cross to bear witness to the crucifixion, the death of Jesus. These three women, it's so interesting. Mary Magdalene, we know from other gospels, but this is the first time Mark has mentioned her. Mm-hmm. Salome, we don't know from anywhere else, certainly not in the Gospel of Mark. And then Mary, who is here called the mother of James, is in chapter 15 called the mother of James and Joseph. Mm-hmm. And those are the names of two of Jesus's brothers, we find out earlier in Mark's gospel. And so maybe that's Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But if so, it seems weird that you wouldn't just say that.
That is fascinating. Yes.
Or the other alternative is it's another Mary that we just don't know.
Right.
I don't know I don't know if that makes a difference. I mean, the one interpretation of that is these are three women. We also are a little bit surprised that there were women followers of Jesus in Mark's gospel. Mark doesn't really talk about them, really, until that chapter 15 text. And now suddenly, here they are, maybe the most faithful of them, but they are women who are otherwise unknown up until now, unless that's Jesus's mother, in which case I don't know what Mark is up to there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like you could just write a whole, that's a fascinating idea if it was the mother of Jesus, but she is not here called the mother of Jesus, or it could just be these were common names. A lot of people had these names.
Yeah, there were a few Marys, Miriams running around in those days.
Right. Bobby, do you happen to know if it was like typically women who did these anointings or if that was not a gendered role?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, in my own head it is, but I mean, Joseph of Arimathea in other gospels anoints Jesus before his burial. Here he doesn't.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't know, historically speaking, about the gendered practice of anointing.
Mm.
But on the point of anointing, like they've gotten up early in the morning, they've gone and bought spices, and they're going to anoint Jesus's body. Can you just talk to me about why do you think they're doing that? Why are they so they could have slept in a little bit, but
why is it so urgent? Why is it so urgent? And I will say I think is much more in my head than in Mark's head, but even just the phrase they rose, you know, that they, the emphasis on the fact that they got up first thing in the morning to do this made me think of Abraham in Genesis 22, when, you know, God gives him this really insane commandment to sacrifice his son. And it says he got up early in the morning, which the rabbis always read as like, you are eager to do the thing you know you have to do, even though you don't want to do it and it will be excruciating. Mm. I don't know if the women feel any of that. I mean, I would imagine they feel tenderness around the death of Jesus, but maybe they also feel good at the prospect of being in the presence of his body and being able to honor his body in that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important in Jewish tradition that the body of any deceased person is treated honorably, and there still are in Jewish communities, we call them societies, but I guess that's sort of a strange word, but groups of people who care for the bodies of the deceased in particular ways before their burial. And this kind of care is seen as one of the greatest mitzvot you can do, because it is certainly not, there's no expectation that it can be repaid in any way. And you're just, you know, you're bringing honor to someone who can never do anything for you. And because it is such an honored thing, it's kept secret who are the people who do that kind of work
I love that tradition.
Within a community.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This is a little bit different, of course, than what modern Jewish practice looks like. But feeling the urgency of being able to go and and be with his body and honor it. I don't know, that feels really real and human to me.
Yes. Typically, of course, the body would have been anointed before it was placed in the tomb in the first place. And so that sort of like tenderness that you're talking about with regard to the body, they haven't been able to do it because the things were so rushed on Friday. And so I think there is some sense in which they want to be with Jesus. There's also some sense in which they had wanted to properly respect him originally. They couldn't do it. And so at the very first possible moment that the sun has come up, they can get out, the shop is open, they can buy their spice. Like they're wanting to make sure that Jesus is treated with the respect that that he deserves and that all human beings deserve.
Yeah.
You get no sense from this text that they were, I mean, they're going to anoint his dead body, right? You get no sense that they're curious about whether he's been resurrected or like, what are they going to find? Like, they're pretty clear that they're going to go find a dead body that they're going to anoint. This might also remind us of that Mark 14 text that we read about the woman who pours the oil over Jesus, and Jesus interprets that as his anointing for burial, which probably didn't make sense to the people in the timeline of the story at the time that it happened. But now it does make sense that that was the time that Jesus was anointed for death.
Yeah.
So when they come to the tomb, they're asking each other, who's going to roll away the stone from the entrance? I don't quite know what to make. Like, surely they knew that there was a stone in front of the entrance. Like, is it just that they haven't made a very good plan or like, you know what I mean? Like, why is Mark tell us this way, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think part of the reason that Mark tells it this way is just so that we know that there is a big stone in front of the tomb. Right. And also, like, you know, burial practices were different at that time. And so this body has not been laid in the ground, but it has been laid in a place where it was expected to stay for a while. And no one was expected to be going in there and doing stuff. Like, this is... You know, what they're doing is sort of counter to the systems as they run.
Yes.
To me, I think I read it as sort of scrappy. Like, I kind of like it. They're like, okay, like, we want to do this great religious act, and there are going to be real logistical complications here, and we're just going to have to figure it out.
Yes.
Like, we're just, somehow we're going to have to move this large rock off the entrance to the tomb. And that, okay, this is the last random Hebrew Bible thing I will mention, I think. The last one, I think.
I love mentioned. Your Hebrew Bible.
We'll see.
Things.
I think just putting my head in creation just had me in the book of Genesis as I was reading this. And so I was remembering when Jacob has just escaped from his murderous brother and is going to live with his uncle. The first time he meets his future wife, Rachel, there are all these sheep collected at the watering hole, but there are not yet enough shepherds gathered for all of them together to be able to roll the stone off the watering hole. Like, a whole bunch of people have to meet there in order for them to do this together. And then Jacob seems to be so inspired by his immediate love for Rachel, that he's able to move rock off the, as he would be, right? He lifts a car for her, right? But he's able to move the rock off. But I don't know, that story just had me thinking about, again, like another situation where a new life is starting, and there's a way in which, in order for it to start, you need access to what's behind that rock, but you don't know how you're possible.
Yes.
How could you possibly get access to it.
I really love that connection to the Jacob story. And then, you know, then there's, you know, the interpretive move there is, as you were saying, is you can do things you didn't know you could do for the one that you love. And so Jacob did that for Rachel, and here the women are going to do it for Jesus because he is the one that they love. And so they're going to make it happen. One other thing that you could do with this text is, you know, this has been a very male disciple dominated gospel all the way up until the crucifixion. And then Judas betrayed, Peter denied, everybody ran away. And then we just haven't seen any men in this story. And so one way of reading it is that the women might have taken one of the male disciples or a couple of them with them to roll away the stone if they had been around to do it. Mm. But the men have sort of disappeared. Yeah. They have abandoned. So the women are going to do what they've got to do. Like, we don't know how we're going to do it.
We don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to figure it out.
So they're
going to
go make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot.
When they ask this question, Mark says they looked up and saw that the stone had been rolled away, and it was a very large stone.
Mm-hmm.
I paused right there just because I wanted to just capture the moment of the stone's not there before we start interpreting what that means. So I'm just curious about how do you imagine what's going on in the women's head at that moment?
I mean, what I sort of read into them at this moment is that they would think something's wrong.
Yeah.
Like, this body has been laid in a peaceful place, not exactly as we would have wanted, but the best we could do on a Friday. And we came back, but it is not undisturbed. You know,
yes.
Like seeing that someone's burial place has been disturbed is, you know, that is not good.
So maybe they have a little panic that there's been a
grave robber. I would have a little panic. Something bad has happened is what I would think.
Yes. It's so interesting that the word that Mark chooses to use there is anableppo, which one could just say bleppo, right? Saw. But anableppo can be read looked up, which is how it was translated in the CEB.
Yeah.
It can also be read their eyes were opened, which is a term that is used elsewhere in Mark's gospel when blind people receive their sight, most famously back in that story in chapter 8, in which there was that double healing of the blind man. So there's an ambiguity in the Greek here, which could be they looked up, like they were talking to each other. They just didn't, they hadn't looked up yet. And then when they look up, they see. You could also read it as something shifted for them in which suddenly they've been given their sight.
Mm.
And we talked about that sort of receiving one's sight in Mark's gospel has had these kind of two senses. One is literally receiving your sight, but the other is seeing what is true, which has until now been somehow obscured for you.
Wow.
I wonder if Mark uses that word with that ambiguity on purpose to capture both of those senses.
Any thoughts about that? I mean, I don't know what Mark is doing on purpose or not on purpose, although he does seem to like to speak on different levels so that people can understand it
right
at wherever they are. But I mean, I feel like everything we've talked about leading up to this is like the world has shifted. Like the world is a different place now than it was before Shabbat in ways that they don't know.
Yes.
But they're about to see.
Yes.
And so the idea that they need some like sort of cosmic new eyes to be able to do that. Like first they needed to be serious enough about the task to say like, we're going to get up early. We're going to get the spices. We're going to think through how the heck we're going to move that rock because we're going to do this. This is not an abstract idea. It's like all of those things go into this moment that like that their commitment, I feel like contributes in some way to that the cosmos shifting what they can see and what they can't see.
I really like that way of reading it. And there, so the seeing of... As they see that the rock is rolled away, they are suddenly given their sight in this deeper sense. Mm-hmm. Sort of in that same moment, the world opens up to them and they can see what is true. Mark pauses again to say it was a very large stone, which it's passive voice in aorist tense. So it had been rolled away is how it's translated. And so I think my own reading of that is that once you kind of know where the story is headed, right? Like once you've been given eyes to see that this is a divine passive is how one would understand it. And that it's been, the aorist is sort of communicating it. It had been rolled away in the past in a way that is not continuing on into the present. So it is one way of reading it is sort of, it's been rolled away once and for all. Never again is that barrier between human and the resurrected Jesus going to be present again. I might be overreading a little. I might be pressing a little.
No, I mean, I like that. I like that sort of, you know, I was thinking before just in terms of like the the connection to the Jacob story, that the rock is the thing that is keeping, in that case, the sheep, in this case, you know, the people, who we can also compare to sheep, is blocking them from something that is life-giving to them.
Yes.
And so the idea that it has been rolled away once and for all seems very much in keeping with what's happening here.
Hi, everyone. It's Bobby here. We're excited to announce our 2024 summer series on biblical images of creation. This 6-part series begins in May after Pentecost and includes texts from Genesis, Job, Psalms, Leviticus, and Ezekiel. We're especially excited to be collaborating with Spirit and Truth Publishing, which has released a Vacation Bible School and all-age Sunday school curriculum designed by experienced Christian educators called Learning Together, Created to Care, which can be used in parallel with the Bible Worm podcast on creation. For more information, visit spiritandtruthpublishing.com, patreon.com/Bible Worm Podcast, or look for our posts in the Narrative Lectionary Facebook group. We're looking forward to talking about creation with you this summer. In the meantime, let's get back to this week's podcast. All right, you ready to see what happens next?
I'm ready.
Picking up in verse 5. Going into the tomb, they saw a young man in a white robe seated on the right side, and they were startled. But he said to them, "Don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He isn't here. Look, here's the place where they laid him. Go tell his disciples, especially Peter, that he is going ahead of you into Galilee. You will see him there just as he told you." Overcome with terror and dread, they fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were very afraid. Here ends the Gospel of Mark and the Easter story according to Mark. We'll deal with that in verse 8 in a minute.
I know. Here comes the Easter bunny.
Hopping down the bunny trail. So when they go into the tomb, they see this, what Mark describes as a young man in a white robe.
Yeah.
You have thoughts about this young man described in this way?
I really enjoy thinking of him as like the narrator part in a musical.
Yeah.
You know, like the guy in Pippin or no. I mean, what's interesting to me here, and tell me if this is normal for Mark, because maybe it is. He's telling us, from what I can tell, what the women's experience is. What the women see is a young man.
Yes.
Presumably, this is not just a young man. This is some kind of angelic being. But Mark doesn't say that.
Right.
But Mark could say that.
Yes.
Mark could even say, looked like a young man, but was an angel. And so I find it really interesting that he is for the most part holding us in the women's experience of this moment and not some bigger.
I love that way of reading
omniscient
it.
Thing.
So holding us in the women's experience, which then is becoming, I mean, it becomes our experience as readers too.
Yeah.
Like we think that's an angel, but we don't know that's an angel. Like surely it's an angel, right? He knows things.
Right.
But there's always that question, and the women have that question. We're sort of left with that question. I like that. Mark and Luke put a finer point on it and say it was an angel. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Mark, if he had even said someone who looked like a young man dressed in white, you would kind of hear.
Yeah, you'd hear that he's not really a young man.
But right.
He just says he's a young man.
But here you just don't know. And I really like that sort of not putting too fine a point on it that Mark seems to be doing here. Because I think that's kind of human experience, right? You encounter things that are, maybe they're divine, but you don't know that they're, like, there's almost always a human interpretation of miraculous things, and you don't know whether you're seeing a miracle or not. Mm-hmm. And there's like, you just have to make some choices about it.
I think that's exactly right. You can describe the things you see in the terms that you know, which are earthly human terms, because we are earthlings. But yeah, that guy's got to be an angel.
I mean, the first thing he says is don't be alarmed, which is what angels seem to tend to say to people when they encounter people, right? Like, I know this is going to freak you out, but like, like, stay calm. Yeah. So he knows some things, right? You're looking for Jesus, mm-hmm. who was crucified. He has been raised. He isn't here. That's just such an interesting, like, sort of telling of the, it's like the Cliff's Notes or the Spark Notes version of what has happened. Is there anything in what he says there that seems notable to you?
I mean, I think, okay, I'm going to answer your question with a question.
Sure.
I know that, I don't know anything. I think that Jesus had told the disciples that he would be raised.
Yes.
Did these women, do we think they knew?
That's a great question. In the narrative, if you read the narrative very strictly, then no, they don't know this. You would have to suggest that suddenly we realize that Jesus has had women followers this whole time.
Yes.
And you would have to sort of import them into those stories to say, when Jesus is speaking with his disciples, these women were there. But they're never narrated as having been there. So I think this question remains, at the end of the day, it's unanswerable.
I see.
I'm curious what you think if they did or did not, if they had or had not already heard that this was going to happen, if it makes a difference to your reading.
I mean, I think what is, as is so much of Mark, but especially the ending of Mark, what really stands out to me is just how sort of urgent and matter of fact this is. Like, the story is not over.
Right.
He's been raised. He's not here. Here's the next thing that needs to happen.
Yes.
Like, we're not going to stop and sing hallelujah in the tomb.
Yes.
Like, you have to, there's something else.
Yes.
But it seems like if the women hadn't at least had that seed planted in their mind somewhere that this was going to happen, that is a very big ask. That's a very big expectation for them to be able to move at this pace.
Yes. You have no preparation for this. Here it is in three sentences.
Yes.
Now go. Yeah.
Yes. He has been raised. He is not here.
I had not really thought about the question of whether or not they already knew, but it's a really good question. And then even if they did already know, it's still real quick information.
It is still real quick.
But especially if they had no background for even making sense of this, it comes very fast.
Yeah.
One of the things, so he has been raised is an important phrasing. Sometimes Jesus is seen as like himself overcoming death. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Jesus is seen as having been raised by God from the dead. Mm-hmm. This seems to be the second one of those. So it's not by Jesus's own power that he sort of muscled off the chains of death and came out of the tomb, but God has enacted that on his behalf. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it really matters, but Mark is relatively clear about it here in the way he's phrased it.
I think I don't know why that matters, but I feel like it does a little bit because I keep returning, my mind keeps returning to this sort of strange image of Jesus himself pushing the stone off the tomb, but then correcting myself, like, I don't think that's what this is actually saying. I think.
You see it depicted that way sometimes.
But okay.
I mean, like, Mark is not saying that, but sometimes,
that's the way Christian art and stuff. So maybe that's how that got in my head. But yeah, that seems like an important distinction to me.
The other thing here that's interesting to me is the young man calls him Jesus of Nazareth. Mm. He could have used other titles, right? He could have said the son of David or the son of man or the son of God. Yes. He just uses his Jesus of Nazareth is his most human title.
Yes. It's his most humble, his most humble. Yeah.
In verse 7, so go tell his disciples. The CEB has especially Peter. Is that is that what NRSV has?
Mine has tell his disciples and Peter.
Oh, interesting.
Which I thought was strange and I was going to ask you about.
Well, the word there can be translated as in any of those, but it could also be translated as even Peter, which I kind of like. Go tell his disciples, even Peter. Mm-hmm. So it's drawing attention, obviously, to Peter in some kind of a way. Mm-hmm. But it's either as like he's the one who most urgently needs to know, especially him. Or I like to read it as even tell Peter, because Peter, the last thing Peter has done in this gospel is deny Jesus three times.
Yeah.
And so I like that reading of even Peter gets this news, even though he has not been. I mean, none of the male disciples in this text turn out at this moment to have been faithful to Jesus in his time of need. But Peter, other than Judas, Peter kind of most dramatically so.
But I'm thinking back to this conversation we had in our discussion of the Last Supper, where, I mean, I guess you just, in some ways, you just laid the framework for this so well, but where Peter is really struggling with this idea that he could ever possibly desert Jesus and then immediately, like, is not even able to stay awake and is not even, like, he really, his, you know, again, like, the spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak.
Yes.
But Peter, that really, that broke Peter's heart.
Yes.
To know that that was, that's what, that was his capacity in this moment. And I remember you pointing out then that it wasn't that you're going to be abandoned at that point. It was just, you're going to do your best. You're not going to do well.
Yeah.
And then I'll see you in Galilee.
I really love that, Amy. And it sort of erases the distinction between even and especially in an interesting kind of way for me. Because it's making me think of times in my life when I have really disappointed somebody to the point at which I thought maybe they were like done with me. Like no way that person is ever going to trust me again. And that's what Peter has done here. And so you could imagine Peter, exactly as you're saying, so disappointed in himself, so sad about what he's done, that he thinks Jesus would never want to see me. And so that especially then becomes, Peter especially needs to know that I want to see him.
Right.
Which is such a tender move by Jesus.
It is. It is.
Well, I guess it's not Jesus, it's the angel, but you kind of, or the man. Yeah. But you kind of assume, it's hard to keep things straight.
You assume he's getting
here.
His marching orders.
That's exactly what I was thinking. So the young man says that Jesus is going ahead to Galilee where you will see him just as he said. So this is it's such an interesting telling of the resurrection. In the other gospels, we actually see the resurrected Jesus in some way or another. Here there is no resurrected Jesus in this story. There is a promise that if you go to Galilee, you will see him there. But you don't get to see him before you go. There's something similar in Matthew. You remember this last year? There's something similar in Matthew, but then as they're on their way, like Jesus jumps out from behind a bush and is like, "Hey!"
I think I do remember that.
But that doesn't happen in Mark. There's no Jesus like lurking in the shadows.
No.
I'm just so curious, like, what do you think of that? Like, when you go to Galilee, you'll see Jesus there. Remember, we're in Jerusalem right now. Like, it's quite a journey.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about that telling?
You know, it is reminding me of a conversation that we had, I don't even know how many years ago, about the Passover story, like the Exodus story.
Yeah.
And you asked me what I thought would have happened. It was like an imagination question. If people hadn't put the blood on their doorposts or whatever, if the angel of death really would have eaten them up.
Yeah.
And I think the conversation we had after that was sort of like, well, not necessarily, but faith has to ask something of you and you have to keep stretching to do each thing. And if you're not stretching to do the next thing, at some point you're just not going to be able to do it. Cause at some point it's going to get really hard.
Yes.
And you kind of build your muscle by doing each incremental thing. And so I feel like going to Galilee, like deciding, even if you don't know in that moment, whether you believe this is actually for real or not, are you willing to do the next thing and go to Galilee? I just feel like it gives you a little more strength for what is still going to be a hard road. You know, Jesus did not promise an easy, an easy road, but it's asking something of them immediately before they can even get, you know, it's not that they got something here. They got an empty tomb, but
somebody telling them what has happened. But they don't get confirmation. You have to go to get the confirmation.
Yeah.
And in the other gospels, it's told differently than that. Yeah. You get the confirmation. Here's Jesus jumping out from behind the bush. And so now go to Galilee. Okay, I can do that because I know.
Because I know.
In Mark's gospel, it's you got to go. It takes you, you've been talking about Genesis a lot. It takes you back to that Abraham story again.
Yes.
When God first shows up to Abraham and says, I'm going to, like, you got to go.
And you then just got to go. And we'll talk about it later.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now the women's response. So to their credit, the women are there. When Jesus is crucified, they are there. On Easter morning, they have come to the tomb. Like they are the ones who have been most consistent here at the end of the gospel. But in this very last verse, overcome with terror and dread, they fled from the tomb and said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And this is the last thing we hear in this gospel, since is like a frightened silence. Can you help me start thinking about what to do with that?
I mean, it just seems to me so much like it, like so many of Jesus's conversations with his disciples, this recognition that humans are kind of a mess. I get, you know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Yes.
That, you know, this is a genuinely amazing and terrifying thing. And they were, it seems, were overwhelmed. They couldn't push past that.
Yeah.
They got stuck right there. And that's relatable, I will say. Like it's not like a happy ending to the story. But what has happened, what seems to have happened, what they have seen is so completely beyond the world order as they have always understood it, and they get stuck there. They can't move through and see what is going to happen afterwards.
I love that way of talking about it, Amy, that it's just this is so relatable. And then, you know, it's such an interesting telling of the Easter story. Like we're supposed to be like playing trumpets and like shouting he is risen, and like it's this glorious day. And here, this ends with, look, people are scared and they don't know how to handle this news. And that shuts them down. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of right. And also it's Easter. You know, it seems as though somebody eventually is going to go to Galilee, because here we are talking about the Jesus story.
Something happened. Yeah.
But it's so interesting that it's not narrated here. And so it seems like even here at the very end, the women who have been the most faithful at this last part of the gospel, they have a moment where they falter. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because, I mean, it seems like they're the only ones in the whole world who know. And so this could have ended with them. Mm-hmm. It's been entrusted to them. And they seem eventually to do something with it. But the reader is kind of left here thinking, I don't know, like, it feels urgent, right? Like, oh, wait, no, we know with the gospel, and it's got to be told.
Yeah.
I've been reading Eugene Boring's commentary, and he thinks that Mark tells the story this way. You know, Mark is a really good storyteller. Like you can see him sort of sitting around telling stories and people like getting just the way he narrates things, not necessarily like his flowery language, but just the way he constructs narrative. And Boring's argument is, which I think is really interesting, is that the reader turns out to be the only one who's left at the end of the story. Like we were with Jesus at the beginning when he was baptized. We heard God say, you are my son, the beloved. We've known since the beginning. We knew Jesus was the Messiah when the disciples couldn't get their heads around it. We were at the Mount of Transfiguration. We were in the wilderness when Jesus was tempted. Like we were at the cross when Jesus died. And I'm like, oh, that's really true. Like the reader really has been brought along. And here we are at the end. And we know that that somebody needs to go to Galilee. And ain't nobody going. And so the Boring's argument, which I'm really taken by, is so now the reader has to take action. The women in the narrative are not telling anybody. So are you going to go? Are you going to go to Galilee and see if Jesus is there? Are you going to go tell Peter? I've been so taken by that idea that this version of the Easter story puts the reader in the position of having to make a choice. The future of the gospel depends on you.
Mm.
What are you going to do with it?
I love that, Bobby. And I love seeing the reader as like a character in the story.
Yeah.
Really? If we're thinking about the story as like, this is part of the divine narrative of history. Like, this is not just, 25 pages in your Bible or whatever. We are part of that story. We are the continuation of that story. So I love the idea that it pulls readers in directly, and that we have, now we're the ones who caught the ball. Like, we have to do something.
Right.
I love also that, I've been reading from some Jewish stuff and some Christian stuff on the idea of discernment and trying to discern what it is God would want you to do, or what choices you could make in your life that would bring you closer or less close to God. And one of the things that I have most liked in that reading is the idea that, like, you have to do the work of discernment, but for the most part, God will work with whatever you do. Like, if you, like, like, you know, like, okay, this is not really what I was telling you to do, but like, okay, we're just gonna figure out a different way. So even if the plan for real was like, these women really were supposed to go to Galilee. And they didn't. Okay, the story didn't end there. Yes. Like, just like all the times along the way that all the humans around Jesus were overwhelmed by the enormity of this story that they were directly in.
Yes.
You know, we as readers are a little bit outside of it. We don't have to, we're not physically experiencing it. And so I wouldn't want us to be judgmental of the humans in the story who just can't roll with this so easily. But I really like the idea that, like, there was a plan. This is what they were supposed to do.
Yes.
They did not do it. And the story theoretically could have ended right there.
Yes.
They didn't do it. The chain's broken.
Yes.
Too bad. We have to start over.
Yes.
But that's not what happened.
I really like that, Amy. And yes, I absolutely agree with you that the characters in the story, my own reading of it is that after verse 16:8, the women pull themselves together, they go and tell the disciples, which is how it happens in Matthew's gospel. And eventually people do go to Galilee. Like, I think the women pull through, and that's how the gospel gets spread. But I really, really like that Mark does not tell it that way for exactly the reason you're saying. And so that even a reader 2,000 years later who's reading it is still pressed with the question, are you going to go to Galilee? Mm-hmm. If people stop going to Galilee, then the gospel stops being told.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the women went, even if the women went, mm-hmm. you still got to go, dear reader.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Amy. So here we have an Easter text with no appearance of the resurrected Jesus. And it's what we get from Mark. And so I'm curious. I know it's a lot to ask my Jewish friend and colleague to interpret the Easter story for a largely Christian audience. But that's what I'm curious about.
That's the task. Well, okay, here is where my mind sort of lands at the end of this. And it has a lot to do with where Mark leaves us in this story. A couple weeks ago, I was at this prayer leadership retreat, and there were these quotes hanging in the sanctuary. And one of the quotes was from Abraham Joshua Heschel. And the line I remember is, prayer is our humble response to the inconceivable surprise of living.
Oh, I love that.
It's a gorgeous quote. And since I've come back from the retreat, I have sometimes struggled because I'm like, I'm not actually that surprised today. Like, I don't feel surprised. I feel today looks like yesterday looked, and And if I need the surprise to motivate the next thing, to motivate the prayer, sometimes my struggle is really like, how do I get back to that moment of inconceivable surprise? And this, that I feel like that is the moment that this text leaves you in.
Yes.
Where like the enormity of what has happened is inconceivable. It is paralyzing.
Yes.
It doesn't take you into the next moment where the sort of prayer and acts of faith and all of the things emerge. But at least for me in my own life of faith right now, the struggle is staying in that place of surprise.
Yes.
And so I am kind of really appreciating that Mark has left us exactly there. Like if we can feel how inconceivable this story is, how impossible it is, and yet here it is, that will lead to everything else. Mm-hmm. Like we'll figure out all the next steps. But once this story becomes just like, sure, that's what happened and it was lovely and now we have an Easter dinner to go to, like
right.
That's, you know, I don't know. This is where the power of the story is for me. And so I like that he leaves us here and assumes we'll be able to get to the next place eventually.
Leaving you in the surprise. I love that way of talking about it, Amy. And, you know, this is Mark's version of the Easter story is probably my favorite. It is less lovely than some of the others. Like John's version of the Easter story has him comforting Mary, who is weeping in the garden. And like, there's some beautiful things in there, but this one to me is the one that really resonates. And it's the one that doesn't have Jesus in it, you know? And I love your way of articulating that as it leaves you in the moment of surprise, because it does surprise you. And then you have to think, how do I tell the Easter story without landing the plane, right? And that's it's a challenge. Mm. The other thing that I love about this story is it withholds evidence from us. And it says, look, there is a tomb with a stone rolled away. Mm-hmm. There is a young man who may or may not be an angel who tells us that Jesus is in Galilee. But we don't know that. I can't look and see. Like Thomas in John's gospel, I can't put my hands in the holes of Jesus's wounds. And to me, this is the way that I feel like I live my life. Like I don't have the evidence.
Yeah.
And if I want the evidence, I'm going to be perpetually frustrated. So this Easter story, as we were saying earlier, calls for a response that anticipates evidence, but doesn't actually have it. And to me, this is the way Christian life is, or life of faith in general is. It is responding to something that we believe to be true, we have been told is true, but we can't see it or hold it or take pictures of it. And I don't know, like for whatever reason, I think it's just because that seems like life as I live it. I really love that. The way I experience the world in which the evidence is always out in front of me someplace.
Yeah.
It's comforting to me. The other Easter stories I really love, but I've never had that experience of Jesus putting his hand on my shoulder in the garden and saying, Williamson, you got a good podcast. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know what Jesus thinks about Bible Worm, but if I get to Galilee, you know.
Yeah. Right. It's always out in front of you a little bit and you have to move in that direction even before you have that.
And it's scary. And I can totally see myself getting shut down about it and not ever saying anything to anyone. And yet here I go.
Yeah. Really powerful ending.
All right, Amy. Well, this is the end of the Gospel of Mark. It is the end of the narrative lectionary time in the Gospels. Next time, we're moving on to the book of Acts, which is going to carry us to Pentecost, along with Paul's letter to the Corinthians, the first letter to the Corinthians, which is going to carry us from now until sometime in May.
Oh, miss Mark.
I will miss Mark too. I love Mark.
Well, I'm glad we read this book together, and we'll see what Acts has in store for us.
All right. Thanks, Amy. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. If you've enjoyed this free podcast, we hope you'll help us keep it going by joining our Patreon for as little as $4 per month. You can also sign up for other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced and edited by Bobby Williamson. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby, and our theme music is The World at Large by Dano Songs. Many thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping make this podcast possible.
Join us next time when we'll begin our post-Easter readings with Acts 1:1-14. Until then, keep on digging.